Ashton Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE. Today is the self-styled International Court of Justice deadline for EU Anglo-American armed Israel to respond to demands to halt military action against 2 million, mostly women and children, in Gaza. If you're unlucky enough to watch NATO propaganda media, the conflict began on October the 7th, not with the British Balfour Declaration of 1917. And October the 7th, though, is the subject of a new book, Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, The Defeat to the Vanquisher. It's by Colonel Jacques Beau, a former NATO analyst and head of the UN Department of Peacekeeping Operations, Peace Policy and Doctrine Division. He's also been a Swiss colonel, once neutral Switzerland, recently playing host to a Ukraine conference, billed as a peace conference. It actually didn't invite one of the parties to the conflict in Europe. Instead, Switzerland was where Washington proxy politicians emphasized the need to target China as well as Russia, and the importance of stealing money belonging to the Russian people to give to a Ukraine now led by a regime that has abolished democracy. Colonel Jacques Beau is in Brussels, home to NATO headquarters. Thanks so much, Colonel, for coming back on.
That's my pleasure.
Well, you know, before I mentioned your country that you fought for. Before I get to Al-Aqsa Flood, I've got to talk about what you thought of this bizarre Swiss conference. Switzerland long lost the neutrality that it was loved for a century, two centuries, three centuries. What's happened to your country?
We are in a bizarre period of time. In fact, because obviously this conference was definitely not a good publicity for neutrality, but the whole policy Switzerland has waged in the framework of your Ukrainian conflict or the Ukrainian crisis is in fact the abandonment, we can say, of the neutrality policy. I mean, you may or may not know that Switzerland is the third most sanctioning country of Russia. We sanction even more Russia than the EU. And that's from the very beginning of the special military operation. So, meaning that this is the sign that we are, in fact, a party to the conflict. And because this conflict was seen from the West as an economic conflict. I mean, the purpose of this conflict, despite everything that happens on the field, from a Western perspective, the purpose of this conflict is to weaken, if not destroy, Russia. And the destruction is basically, essentially based on sanctions, meaning that if you have Switzerland as the third most sanctioning party in this conflict, we are definitely a party of the conflict. And that raised a lot of question in Switzerland itself. And a lot of opposition party have raised this question and have opposed the policy of Switzerland, but somehow this is the foreign policy, and we applied the rules that were defined in the treaty we have with European Union. So this is just the application of treaties, but de facto.
Sorry, Colonel, what is it? Terrible schools? What's happened to the country? I mean, you know, do they not listen to a former colonel in the Swiss army who was a NATO official in Ukraine like yourself? I mean, what is wrong with these Swiss politicians that they wanted to abandon? I mean, it depends on who you are. It's obviously Antony Blinken wouldn't say they're going wrong. They're doing the right thing. But why did they want to abandon neutrality and clearly side with Washington?
I have no idea. But the fact of the matter is that if you look at the composition of the Swiss Federal Council, which is basically the coalition that rules the country. And if you look at the composition, you will see it's very close to what you have in our neighboring countries. I mean, young people with very little experience, very little professional experience. They are not so old, I mean, in the 40s or so. And they are all from center-right, a center-right type of political orientation. And these guys think that because Russia is considered as a non-democracy, or China, or whoever, then we are allowed to use any policy to fight them. And that's a little bit the problem. But basically, we have exactly the same kind of behavior as the Germans or Emmanuel Macron and his government. You know, it's during the Cold War, we didn't consider whether Soviet Union was a dictatorship or not. We just had relationships with Soviet Union, period. We were not making a judgment on the way they were conducting the country. And our effort was to avoid that. I mean, we didn't want this type of a government in our countries, but we didn't care about what happened in the other ones. But since about 30 years, we tend to focus on the way others rule their country and to try to influence domestic policies. And in essence, this is exactly the foreign policy that has been waged by the US since 1991. It's trying to influence domestic policy. It's a total contradiction to the UN Charter, by the way.
And the Swiss Constitution, actually talking about that, do they not realise that there are going to be people talking in the Global South about the need to get rid of the UN headquarters in Geneva, because there's one in New York and in Geneva, of course, and all those UN agencies that are in Switzerland, they don't belong there. Does the Red Cross belong in Switzerland now that Switzerland is a belligerent in the war?
I don't think we can see the problem that way, because those institutions, I mean, you have UN institutions, for instance, in USA, and USA is waging war. So, you know, this is not, I think we shouldn't go too far in terms of the multilateral issues and the policy of Switzerland, foreign policy of Switzerland. It's just a problem. I mean, the issue, and I think Alan Dulles, who used to be the director of the CIA, who, by the way, it happened, he was the chief of the OSS, I mean, the Office of Strategic Services during World War II, and the headquarters of the OSS in Europe was in Bern, Switzerland, during World War II. And he knew perfectly Switzerland. And after World War II, as the US tried to stigmatize the neutral countries, because in the eyes of the US, you are either with them or against them, period. There is no intermediate position. But Alan Dulles, in fact, was kind of an advocate for Switzerland and for Swiss neutrality in the 60s, because he said, and I think his thinking was right, that if you have a neutral country, it offers an exit ramp to conflict. And that's probably not a surprise if you had Switzerland as a place to negotiate conflict. Remember the START, the SALT negotiations between Soviet Union and the US, but also other conflicts like the Iran-US conflict. I mean, remember that the Switzerland represents US interests in Tehran and Iranian interests in the US. So, and that was the same with Cuba, by the way. Since Obama reestablished diplomatic relationship with Cuba, this has been dropped. But basically, we used to represent Cuban interests in US and vice versa. So a neutral country is always useful when you want to stop a crisis, because then you have a space where you can allow a negotiation to happen. Well, you know, anyway, if you look at
China fulfilled
today,
that role.
Nobody would negotiate.
China fulfilled that role recently vis-a-vis Saudi Arabia, of course. With Syria. But I mean, you heard it here first, Colonel Jacques Beau extolling the virtues of Alan Dulles, the head of OSS. I think people can read more into Alan Dulles and what else he got up to. But I do want to get onto the book, because obviously the whole world is concerned about Gaza. And funny enough, actually, when you read Primo Levi escaping to Switzerland from the Holocaust, one of the great novels about the Holocaust, Primo Levi, the great novelist, it makes you realise what Switzerland once meant. Let's just get on to the Al-Aqsa Flood book. What do you make of the way the word resistance is used in NATO media, by historians, by think tanks? Because in your book, you say they don't, these people who talk, even at the UN, about the resistance in Palestine, don't even understand the concept of what resistance is.
Well, there's a confusion in the West, which is basically also a propaganda thing, because we tend to make, deliberately, by the way, a confusion between resistance and terrorism. And here we have to make a semantic difference between the two. Resistance means, it basically is defined by an objective, to resist an occupation or whatever. But it is basically resistance is defined by the objective of resisting, while terrorism is not an objective. Terrorism is a way of achieving an objective. So in the Western wording today, we tend to mix the way and the objective. And that's why it's easy then to say that, and that was a scandal in France, as a journalist asked a politician whether Hamas was a resistance or a terrorist movement. But basically, regardless of how you consider Hamas, although I consider that Hamas has left terrorism in the early 90s, but this is another discussion. But the thing is that if you ask whether Hamas is a terrorist or resistance organization, in essence, regardless of what you think, it can be both, because resistance just expresses the objective of the organization, while terrorism would express the strategy it used to achieve that objective. So basically, the two words are not antagonistic, is in essence, but we play with those words because people never, and in the West, we never really define what terrorism is, in fact. And today, everybody is terrorist. I mean, if you go to France, especially in France, for instance, even if you express some sympathy for Hamas, or better, if you don't express sorrow for the Israeli, then you are considered of sponsoring terrorism. And there was a case recently in a court in France about this. So it becomes totally schizophrenic, because we don't use the right words to define the right things. Now, when it comes to Hamas and the Palestinian resistance, it is a resistance. And they may have used different means and different ways of doing that throughout the years. I mean, we had terrorist attack of the Palestinian organizations, not just Hamas, but others, especially in the 60s and the 70s.
We're going to have to go to a break. We'll return to this in a moment. Colonel Jacques Beau, I'll stop you there. More from the author of Operation Al-Aqsa Flood after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with retired Swiss Army Colonel and former NATO analyst Jacques Beau. Colonel, I rudely interrupted you about what you were saying about this complicated idea of resistance in the imaginations of Western nations. Those countries that did go to the Swiss conference, UAE, Saudi, Brazil, India, less so India, very critical of Israel and seen as part of the resistance, accused of it as being part of the resistance by Zionists in NATO nations. China didn't go to the Swiss conference. Do you think you can see that the Swiss conference on Ukraine has parallels to Gaza? The Ukraine conflict and the Gaza conflict is part of the geopolitical seismology.
Well, definitely, yes. And in fact, what this conference has shown, besides the outcome about Ukraine, which is basically no real outcome about the peace in Ukraine, but what it shows clearly is the increasing a split between the Western world and the rest of the world. And if you noticed, the final communique of the conference was not signed by the most important countries of the, let's say, the global South, meaning that those who could have had some kind of leverage on Russia didn't sign the communique, meaning that this the whole exercise was a total failure from the very beginning. Even before the conference, in fact, the president of the conference, Mrs. Viola Amert, who is incidentally also the defense minister at the same time, she said that probably she should convene another conference after. So that was in end of May, but by the way, it was more than 3 weeks ago. She said probably we should convene another conference after the Bürgenstock conference because we don't have Russia on board. And, you know, it was doomed to fail, and it failed. And it's the only outcome, I think, is to show this split between the South and the Western world. So that's my,
another
my
conference.
Main conclusion.
I'm sure that'll cheer the mothers of dying children in who are serving Zelensky in Ukraine. So actually, in the book, Alexa Flood, you talk about Israel not really having a coherent response to at what the resistance is doing in Palestine, apart from extermination. Again, parallels there with the lack of coherence in the NATO response, because they're clearly not winning the war against Russia, the proxy war against Russia, unless, and both those countries would say, Israel would say, no, we are, some of their cabinet ministers were saying, we're doing quite well, we are exterminating as many men, women and children as possible in the Gaza Strip. And the Americans would say we're getting closer and closer to an entire Western united front in NATO and nuclear war. I'm not sure what their coherent response is.
Well, let's put the nuclear war aside for a while and let's concentrate on the Middle East. But it's interesting to see that, in fact, in the last 30 years and even more, NATO has not won any war. Not a single one. So, and the US has been defeated in every war it has been. So the with the probable exception of the first Gulf War in 1991, but this was an unachieved war to some extent. So, but despite this, the problem in counterinsurgency and the counterinsurgency strategy that Israel is waging goes against all the rules of counterinsurgency. I have been specially trained in the British Armed Forces in counterinsurgency in the 80s during the war in Northern Ireland. So I'm aware of how you should handle a counterinsurgency situation. The Israeli have done everything wrong to address this. And the only explanation for that, and I wrote this already 20 years ago in a book on asymmetric warfare based on the Second Intifada. And at that time I said, well, there are two options. Either the Israeli are stupid and they don't understand how to wage war, or they do that on purpose in order to eliminate Palestinians. Now, my conclusion after what we have seen in Palestine in the last I would say the last year, because the 7th of October is just the tipping point of a crisis that has started much earlier last year. In any case, what we have seen is a constant consistent approach of the Israeli to eliminate Palestinians. They are not trying to solve the problem on the political on a political dimension or political side, as we normally should for counterinsurgency. They are doing that by brute force, meaning that they destroy people, and that's the name of the game. By the way, what we see in the West Bank shows exactly what the Israeli wants to do. That means pushing the Palestinians out of Palestine. And there is nothing new on that. This was already written in the 40s. You had already people theorizing the growth or the establishment of the Israeli state. And this was clearly said. This is the Palestine will be exclusively Jew. And that has always been the consistent policy. The only problem is that they don't dare to do it in one shot, so meaning that they are doing that brutal sequences that we had sometimes in the West Bank, sometimes in Gaza, and so on. But the ultimate goal is to empty Palestine from Palestinians.
Of course, they would point to the fact that they allow Christians and Arabs in Israel, as constructed now, to be, as they often say, Supreme Court judges, etc., etc. They allow Christians to worship at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre.
They do, but they don't have the same rights. You know, that's also something which defies our definition of democracy or the rule of law in Western countries. Because if you are in France, for instance, even if the Corsicans would like to be independent, they still have the same rights as the French. And the same applies to other countries in Europe, regardless of your skin color, of your political orientation, or whatever, you are still entitled to the same rights.
Okay, Colonel, I think it's been obviously this viewpoint is not allowed in some cases under certain definitions of anti-Semitism, bizarrely. But I want to get on, actually, to the who's helping this genocide, enabling it. I mean, obviously, Britain, the United States, the EU nations are pouring in the weapons. But every day, other day, Antony Blinken's spokespeople at the State Department seem to say, we don't know what's going on yet. We're waiting for the Israelis to report back on this atrocity or that atrocity. Do they not have satellites monitoring what's going on? Is American intelligence deeply involved? I know the British, the base in Cyprus is involved. There have been reports. But is the United States intelligence services, are they intimately involved with what you're talking about here, the extermination of the people?
Well, about the extermination, I mean, the thing is that, you know, I think intelligence services, regardless of from which country they are, they know exactly what's going on. The politicians do something else. They turn a blind eye to that. But I think every intelligence service knows.
They have the spy satellites that can see into Gaza down
to
a meter.
And in fact, no. Remember that the rescue of those four prisoners a few days ago, last week or so in
Nusret refugee camp.
This was done with U.S. intelligence, because even the Israeli had not the intelligence to know that these prisoners were in that location. So even they even needed the Americans for that. So meaning that the Americans know perfectly, and we know, and I mentioned that in my book, by the way, that you have constant overflights from US and British reconnaissance aircraft, high altitude reconnaissance aircraft, coming from Cyprus, and they come and circle around the area of Gaza and Israel in order to monitor the situation. So there's a very clear view on the intelligence side of Western intelligence of what's happening in the Gaza Strip. So there's no question about this. The problem is that the politicians, and we see that perfectly with countries like Germany, for instance. Germany, and that affects probably other European countries as well. They are so deeply affected by the history and what happened during World War II, that they don't dare to criticize the Israeli government. That's the problem. And that's the reason why the Israeli government basically can do whatever it wants, because nobody will condemn. Even if you read my book, I have listed all the UN resolutions that have been violated by the Israeli government since 1947 and or 1948, because Israel was created in May 1948. But all these violations, almost none have been followed by sanctions or blame or whatever.
And these are binding resolutions, as the present U.S. ambassador to the U.N. needs to note, arguably. Well, just finally, we mentioned nuclear weapons. On Konbarama Radio, a Netanyahu cabinet member, famously before he was suspended, although has support, Amichai Eliyahu, said, when asked, your expectation is tomorrow morning we drop what amounts to some kind of nuclear bomb on all of Gaza, flattening them, eliminating everybody there. And he went, that's one way. Why won't the Israelis, if they take on board what you just said, because they're not stupid, why won't they go faster? Because, of course, the Zionists will always reply to what you just said and say, if we really wanted to kill all of them, we'd use the nuclear weapons or some sort of tactical, conventional mass-killing weapons.
Well, they could, but remember that they already have projects for having to rebuild a kind of a colony in Gaza. They are already people who are ready to buy land in Gaza, I mean, Israelis. And so the idea is to empty completely Gaza and then to rebuild a kind of colony as they had until 2005. And you have even those Israeli extremists saying we want a nice view on the sea and all and things like that. So meaning that if you use a nuclear bomb to eliminate the population in Gaza, you will not be able to come back in this area because of radiation and all that. So that's probably the reason why the use of nuclear weapons for that is only a rhetoric question. But still, it indicates the mood of these Israeli officials who want to exterminate the Palestinian. That's the worry, the worrisome part of it. They will not use nuclear weapons because of the technicalities, but they still want to eliminate Palestinians.
Colonel Jacques Beau, thank you.
My pleasure, thank you.
And continued condolences to those bereaved by UK-US-EU armed genocide. That's it for the show. We'll be back with a brand new episode on Saturday. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV, on rumble.com to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Saturday.